This is Mrs. English again, and today I'm reading to you from Homer's Odyssey from the Richmond Lattimore translation, and I'm reading now book 12. Please remember that Odysseus is still telling the stories of his adventures to the Phaeacians. They are sitting up all night listening to him tell his stories. Now when our ship had left the stream of the ocean river, and come back to the wide crossing of the sea's waves, and to the island of Aea, where lies the house of the early dawn, her dancing spaces, and where Helios the sun makes his uprising, making this point, we ran our ship on the sand and beached her, and we ourselves stepped out onto the break of the sea beach, and there we fell asleep and waited for the divine dawn. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, then I sent my companions away to the house of Circe to bring back the body of Elpenor, who had died there. Then we cut logs, and where the extreme of the foreland jutted out, we buried him, sorrowful, shedding warm tears for him. But when the dead man had burned, and the dead man's armor, piling the grave mound and pulling the grave stand to stand above it, we planted the well-shaped oar in the very top of the grave mound. Line 15. So we were busy, each with our various work, nor was Circe unaware that we had come back from Hades. Presently she came, attired, and her attendants followed, carrying bread at her will, and many meats and the shining red wine. Bright among goddesses, she stood in our midst and addressed us. Unhappy men, who went alive to the house of Hades, so dying twice, when all the rest of mankind die only once. Come, then, eat what is there and drink your wine, staying here all the rest of the day. And then tomorrow, when dawn shows, you shall sail, and I will show you the way and make plain all details, so that neither by land nor on the salt water you may suffer and come to grief by unhappy bad designing. So she spoke, and the proud heart in us was persuaded. So for the whole length of the day until the sun's setting, we sat there feasting on unlimited meat and sweet wine. But when the sun went down and the sacred darkness came over, the men lay down to sleep all by the ship's stern cables. But she, taking me by the hand, made me sit down away from my dear companions, and talked with me, and asked me the details of everything, and I recited all just as it had happened. Then the queenly Circe spoke in words and addressed me. So, all that has been duly done. Listen now, I will tell you all, but the very God himself will make you remember. You will come first of all to the Sirens. And this is very interesting, line 39, because we realize that Circe told Odysseus to go down to Hades to talk to Tiresias to find out how to go home. And now he is returned here from Hades, and he did have some excitement there, but now Circe is telling him how to go home. You will come first of all to the Sirens, who are enchanters, line 40, of all mankind, and whoever comes their way, and that man who unsuspecting approaches them and listens to the Sirens singing, has no prospect of coming home and delighting his wife and little children as they stand about him in greeting. But the Sirens, by the melody of their singing, enchant him. They sit in their meadow, but the beach before it is piled with bone heaps of men now rotted away, and the skins shrivel upon them. You must drive straight on past, but melt down sweet wax of honey, and with it stop your companions' ears, so none can listen. The rest, that is, but if you yourself are wanting to hear them, line 50, then have them tie you hand and foot on the ship, fast, standing upright against the mast with the rope's ends lashed around it, so that you can have joy in hearing the song of the Sirens. But if you supplicate your men and implore them to set you free, then they must tie you fast with even more lashings. Then, line 55, for the time when your companions have driven you past them, for that time I will no longer tell you in detail which way of the two your course must lie, but you yourself must consider this in your own mind. I will tell you the two ways of it. On one side, there are overhanging rocks, and against them, line 60, crashes the heavy swell of dark-eyed Amphitrite. The blessed gods call these rocks the rovers. By this way, not even any flying thing, not even the tremulous doves which carry ambrosia to Zeus the Father, can pass through. But every time the sheer rock catches away even one of these, but the Father then adds another to keep the number right. No ship of men that came here ever has fled through, but the waves of the sea and storms of ravening fire carry away together the ship's timbers and the men's bodies. That way, the only sea-going ship to get through was Argo. And of course, this is Jason and the Argonauts, and so the Argo was the only one to get through. Line 70, who is in all men's minds, on her way home from Aietes. And even she would have been driven on the great rocks that time, but Hera saw her through, out of her great love for Jason. But of the two rocks, one reaches up into the wide heaven with a pointed peak, and a dark cloud stands always around it, and never at any time draws away from it, nor does the sunlight ever hold that peak, either in the early or the late summer. Nor could any man who was mortal climb there, or stand mounted on the summit, not if he had 20 hands and 20 feet, for the rock goes sheerly up as if it were polished. Halfway up the cliff there is a cave, misty looking, and turned toward Erebus, the darkness and the dark, the very direction from which, O shining Odysseus, you and your men will be steering your hollow ship. And from the hollow ship no vigorous young man with a bow could shoot to the hole in the cliffside. Line 85, in that cavern Scylla lives, whose howling is terror. Her voice indeed is only as loud as a newborn puppy could make, but she herself is an evil monster. No one, not even a god encountering her, could be glad at that sight. She has 12 feet, and all of them wave in the air. She has 6 necks upon her, grown to great length, and upon each neck there is a horrible head, with teeth in it, set in 3 rows, close together and stiff, full of black death. Her body, from the waist down, is holed up inside the hollow cavern, but she holds her heads poked out and away from the terrible hollow. Line 95, and there she fishes, peering all over the cliffside, looking for dolphins or dogfish to catch, or anything bigger, some sea monster, of whom Amphitrite keeps so many. Never can sailors boast aloud that their ship has passed her without any loss of men, for with each of her heads she snatches one man away, line 100, and carries him off from the dark prowled vessel. The other cliff is lower. You will see it, Odysseus, for they lie close together. You could even cast with an arrow across. There is a great fig tree grows there, dense with foliage, and under this, shining Charybdis, a whirlpool, sucks down the black water. Line 105, for 3 times a day she flows it up, and 3 times she sucks it terribly down. You may not be there when she sucks down water, for not even the earthshaker. May you not be there when she sucks down water, for not even the earthshaker could rescue out of that evil. But sailing your ship swiftly, drive her past and avoid her, and make for Scylla's rock instead, since it is far better to mourn 6 friends lost out of your ship than the whole company. So she spoke, but I in turn said to her in answer, come then, goddess, answer me truthfully this. Is there some way for me to escape away from deadly Charybdis, but yet fight the other one off when she attacks my companions? Line 115. So I spoke, and she, shining among goddesses, answered, hardy man, your mind is full forever of fighting and battle work. Will you not give way even to the immortals? She is no mortal thing, but a mischief immortal, dangerous, difficult, and bloodthirsty, and there is no fighting against her, nor any force of defense. It is best to run away from her, for if you arm for battle beside her rock and waste time there, I fear she will make another outrush and catch you with all her heads and snatch away once more the same number of men. Drive by as hard as you can, but invoke Critias. She's the mother of Scylla, line 125, and bore this mischief for mortals, and she will stay her from making another sally against you. In other words, the best you can do is to hope for only 1 grabbing and 1 loss of 6 men. Then you will reach the island Thrinakia, where are pastured the cattle and the fat sheep of the sun god Helios, 7 herds of oxen and as many beautiful sheep flocks, and 50 to each herd. Line 130. There is no giving birth among them, nor do they ever die away, and their shepherdesses are gods, nymphs with sweet hair, Lampetia and Phethusa, whom shining Nereia bore to Hyperion, the sun god. These, when their queenly mother had given them birth and reared them, she settled on the island Thrinakia, far away, to live there and guard their father's sheep and his horn-curved cattle. Then, if you keep your mind on homecoming and leave these unharmed, you might all make your way to Ithaca after much suffering. But if you do them harm, then I testify to the destruction of your ship and your companions. But if you yourself get clear, you will come home, in bad case, with the loss of all your companions. Again, we have another reminder of that curse of Polyphemus from Book 9, line 534. So she spoke, and dawn of the golden throne came on us. She, shining among goddesses, went away up the island. Then, going back on board my ship, I told my companions also to go aboard and to cast off the stern cables. And quickly they went aboard the ship and sat to the oarlocks, and sitting well in order, dashed the oars in the gray sea. But fair-haired Circe, the dread goddess who talks with mortals, sent us an excellent companion, a following wind, filling the sails, line 150, to carry from astern the ship with the dark prow. We ourselves, over all the ship making fast the running gear, sat there and let the wind and the steersman hold her steady. Then, sorrowful as I was, I spoke and told my companions, "Friends, since it is not right for one or two of us only to know the divinations that Circe, bright among goddesses, gave me, so I will tell you, and, knowing all, we may either die or turn aside from death and escape destruction. First of all, and I'm telling you now, he doesn't tell them everything. First of all, she tells us to keep away from the magical sirens and their singing and their flowery meadow. But only I, she said, line 160, was to listen to them. But you must tie me hard in hurtful bonds to hold me fast in position upright against the mast with the rope's ends fastened around it." And of course, this is the object of much famous art. There's a very, very famous bull with this picture painted on it. "But if I supplicate you and implore you to set me free, then you must tie me fast with even more lashings." Line 165. So, as I was telling all the details to my companions, meanwhile the well-made ship was coming rapidly closer to the Siren's Isle, for the harmless wind was driving her onward. But immediately then the breeze dropped, and a windless calm fell there, and some divinity stilled the tossing waters. My companions stood up and took the sails down and stowed them away in the hollow hull and took their places for rowing and with their planed oar blades whitened the water. Then I, taking a great wheel of wax with the sharp bronze, cut a little piece off and rubbed it together in my heavy hands, and soon the wax grew softer under the powerful stress of the sun and the heat and light of Hyperion's lordling. One after another I stopped the ears of all my companions, and they then bound me hand and foot in the fast ship, standing upright against the mast with the rope's ends lashed around it, and sitting then to row, they dashed their oars in the gray sea. But when we were as far from the land as a voice shouting carries, lightly plying, the swift ship as it drew nearer was seen by the sirens, and they directed their sweet song toward us. "Come this way, honored Odysseus, great glory of the Achaeans, and stay your ship so that you can listen here to our singing, for no one else has ever sailed past this place in his black ship until he has listened to the honey-sweet voice that issues from our lips. Then goes on well pleased, knowing more than ever he did, for we know everything that the Argives and Trojans did and suffered in wide Troy through the gods' despite. Over all the generous earth, we know everything that happens." So they sang in sweet utterance, and the heart within me desired to listen, and I signaled my companions to set me free, nodding with my brows. But they leaned on and rowed hard, and Perimedes and Eurylochus rising up, straightway fastened me with even more lashings and squeezed me tighter. But when they had rowed on past the sirens, and we could no longer hear their voices, and lost the sound of their singing, presently my eager companions took away from their ears the beeswax with which I had stopped them, line 200. Then they set me free from my lashings. But after we had left the island behind, the next thing we saw was smoke and a heavy surf, and we heard it thundering. The men were terrified, and they let the oars fall out of their hands, and these banged all about in the wash. The ship stopped still, with the men no longer rowing to keep way on her. Then I, going up and down the ship, urged on my companions, standing beside each man and speaking to him in kind words. "Dear friends, surely we are not unlearned in evils. This is no greater evil now than it was when the Cyclops had us cooped in his hollow cave by force and violence." Line 210. "But even there, by my courage and counsel and my intelligence, we escaped away. I think that all this will be remembered some day, too. Then do as I say. Let us all be won over. Sit well, all of you, to your oarlocks, and dash your oars deep into the breaking surf of the water. So in that way Zeus might grant that we get clear of this danger and flee away from it. For you, steersmen, I have this order. So store it deeply in your mind as you control the steering oar of this hollow ship. You must keep her clear from where the smoke and the breakers are," line 220, "and make hard for the sea rock, lest, without your knowing, she might drift that way, and you bring all of us into disaster." So I spoke, and they quickly obeyed my words. I had not spoken yet of Scylla, a plague that could not be dealt with, for fear my companions might be terrified and give over their rowing and take cover inside the ship. For my part, I let go from my mind the difficult instruction that Circe had given me, for she told me not to be armed for combat. But I put on my glorious armor, and, taking up two long spears in my hands, I stood bestriding the vessel's foredeck at the prow, line 230. For I expected Scylla of the rocks to appear first from that direction, she who brought pain to my companions. I could not make her out anywhere, and my eyes grew weary from looking everywhere on the misty face of the sea rock. So we sailed up the narrow strait, lamenting. On one side was Scylla, and on the other side was shining Charybdis, who made her terrible ebb and flow of the sea's water. When she vomited it up like a cauldron over a strong fire, the whole sea would boil up in turbulence, and the foam flying spattered the pinnacles of the rocks in either direction. But when in turn again she sucked it down, the salt sea water, the turbulence showed all the inner sea, and the rock around it groaned terribly, and the ground showed at the sea's bottom black with sand, and green fear seized upon my companions. We, in fear of destruction, kept our eyes on Charybdis. Line 245. But meanwhile, Scylla, out of the hollow vessel, snatched six of my companions, the best of them for strength and hands work. And when I turned to look at the ship with my other companions, I saw their feet and hands from below, already lifted high above me, and they cried out to me and called me by name, the last time they ever did it, in heart's sorrow. And, what was it like? As a fisherman with a very long rod on a jutting rock will cast his treacherous bait for the little fishes, and sinks the horn of a field-ranging ox into the water, then hauls them up and throws them on the dry land, gasping and struggling. So they gasped and struggled as they were hoisted up the cliff. Right in her doorway, she ate them up. They were screaming and reaching out their hands to me in this horrid encounter. That was the most pitiful scene that these eyes have looked on in my sufferings as I explored the routes over the water. Line 260. Now, when we had fled away from the rocks and dreaded Charybdis and Scylla, next we made our way to the excellent island of the god, where ranged the handsome wide-browed oxen and many fat flocks of sheep belonging to the sun god Hyperion. While I was on the black ship, still out on the open water, line 265, I heard the lowing of the cattle as they were driven home, and the bleating of sheep, and my mind was struck by the saying of the blind prophet Tiresias the Theban, and also Aeon Circe. Both had told me many times over to avoid the island of Helios, who brings joy to mortals. Then, sorrowful as I was, I spoke and told my companions, "Listen to what I say, my companions. Though you are suffering evils, while I tell you of the prophecies of Tiresias and Aeon Circe, both have told me many times over to avoid the island of Helios, who brings joy to mortals." Line 275. For there they spoke of the most dreadful disaster that waited for us. So drive the black ship onward, and let's pass the island. So I spoke, and the inward heart in them was broken. At once Eurylochus answered me with a bitter saying, "You are a hard man, Odysseus. Your force is greater, your limbs never wear out. You must be made all of iron when you will not let your companions, worn with hard work and wanting sleep, lacking sleep, set foot on this land, where if we did, on the sea-girt island, we could once more make ready a greedy dinner. But you force us to blunder along just as we are through the running night, driven from the island over the misty face of the water. In the nights, the hard storm winds arise, and they bring damage to ships. How could any of us escape sheer destruction if suddenly there rises the blast of a storm from the bitter blowing of the south wind or the west wind, who beyond others hammer a ship apart in despite of the gods, our masters? But now let us give way to Black Knight's persuasion. Let us make ready our evening meal, remaining close by our fast ship, and at dawn we will go aboard and put forth on to the wide sea." Here Eurylochus made a pretty good case. He said, "We don't want to sail at night. Why don't we just park here for the night? We'll eat really close to the ship, just eat right here, and in the morning we'll leave." So spoke Eurylochus, and my other companions assented. Line 295. I saw then what evil the divinity had in mind for us, and so I spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words. "Eurylochus, I am only one man. You force me to it. But come then, all of you, swear a strong oath to me that if we come upon some herd of cattle or on some great flock of sheep, line 300, no one of you in evil and reckless action will slaughter any ox or sheep. No, rather than this, eat at your pleasure of the food immortal Circe provided." So I spoke, and they all swore me the oath that I asked them. But after they had sworn me the oath and made an end of it, we beached the well-made ship inside of the hollow harbor, close to sweet water, and my companions disembarked also from the ship and expertly made the evening meal ready. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, they remembered, and they cried for their beloved companions, whom Scylla had caught out of the hollow ship and eaten. And on their crying a quiet sleep descended. But after the third part of the night had come, and the star changes, Zeus the cloud-gatherer let loose on us a gale that blustered in a supernatural storm, and huddled under the cloud-scuds, land alike and the great water. Night sprang from heaven. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, we berthed our ship, dragging her into a hollow sea-cave, where the nymphs had their beautiful dancing places and sessions. Then I held an assembly and spoke my opinion before them. Line 320. "Friends, since there is food and drink stored in the fast ship, let us then keep our hands off the cattle, for fear that something may befall us. These are the cattle and fat sheep of a dreaded god, Helios, who sees all things and listens to all things." So I spoke, and the proud heart in them was persuaded. But the south wind blew for a whole month long. A month. Nor did any other wind befall after that, but only the south and the east wind, not the one they needed. As long as they still had food to eat and red wine, the men kept their hands off the cattle, striving as they were for sustenance. Then, when all the provisions that had been in the ship had given out, line 330, they turned to hunting, forced to it, and went ranging after fish and birds, anything that they could lay hands on, and with curved hooks, for the hunger was exhausting their stomachs. Then I went away along the island in order to pray to the gods, if any of them might show me some course to sail on. But when, crossing the isle, I had left my companions behind, I washed my hands where there was a place sheltered from the wind, and prayed to all the gods whose hold is Olympus, but what they did was to shed a sweet sleep. on my eyelids. And Eurylochus put an evil counsel before his companions. Line 340. Listen to what I say, my companions, and this is Eurylochus speaking while Odysseus is away taking a nap. Though you are suffering evils, all deaths are detestable for wretched mortals, but hunger is the sorriest way to die and encounter fate. Come then, let us cut out the best of Helios's cattle and sacrifice them to the immortals who hold wide heaven. And if we ever come back to Ithaca, land of our fathers, presently we will build a rich temple to the sun god Helios Hyperion and store it with dedications, many and good. But if, in anger over his high-horned cattle, he wishes to wreck our ship and the rest of the gods stand by him, I would far rather gulp the waves and lose my life in them once for all than be pinched to death on this desolate island. So spoke Eurylochus, and the other companions assented. At once, cutting out from near at hand the best of Helios's cattle, for the handsome, broad-faced, horn-curved oxen were pasturing there, line 355, not far from the dark proud ship, driving these, they stationed themselves around them and made their prayers to the gods, pulling tender leaves from a deep-leaved oak tree, for they had no white barley left on the strong-benched vessel. Then, when they had made their prayer and slaughtered the oxen and skinned them, line 360, they cut away the meat from the thighs and wrapped them in fat, making a double fold, and laid shreds of flesh upon them. And since they had no wine to pour on the burning offerings, they made a libation of water and roasted all of the entrails. But when they had burned the thigh pieces and tasted the vitals, they cut all the remainder into pieces and spitted them. At that time, the quiet sleep was lost from my eyelids. Okay, he woke up. And I went back down to my fast ship and the sand of the seashore. But on my way, as I was close to the oar-swept vessel, the pleasant savor of cooking meat came drifting around me, line 370, and I cried out my grief aloud to the gods immortal, Father Zeus, and you other everlasting and blessed gods, with a pitiful sleep you lulled me to my confusion, and my companion staying here dared a deed that was monstrous. Lampetia of the light robes ran swift with the message to Hyperion the sun god that we had killed his cattle, and angered at the heart he spoke forth among the immortals. Father Zeus, and you other everlasting and blessing gods, punish the companions of Odysseus, son of Laertes, for they outrageously killed my cattle, in whom I always delighted, on my way up into the starry heaven, or when I turned back again from heaven toward earth. Unless these are made to give me just recompense for my cattle, I will go down to Hades and give my light to the dead men. Then in turn, Zeus, who gathers the clouds, answered him, line 385, Helios, shine on as you do among the immortals and mortal men all over the grain-giving earth. For my part, I will strike these men's fast ship midway on the open wine-blue sea with a shining bolt and dash it to pieces. All this I heard afterward from fair-haired Calypso, and she told me she herself had heard it from the guide Hermes. But when I came back again to the ship and the seashore, they all stood about and blamed each other, but we were not able to find any remedy, for the oxen were already dead. The next thing was that the gods began to show forth portents before us. Line 395. The skins crawled, and the meat that was stuck on the spits bellowed, both roast and raw, and the noise was like the lowing of cattle. 6 days thereafter my own eager companions feasted on the cattle of Helios the sun god, cutting the best ones out. But when Zeus the son of Cronos established the seventh day, line 400, then at last the wind ceased from its stormy blowing, and presently we went aboard and put forth on the wide sea, and set the mast upright and hoisted the white sails on it. But after we had left the island, and there was no more land in sight, but only the sky and the sea, then Cronian Zeus, line 405, drew on a blue-black cloud and settled it over the hollow ship, and the open sea was darkened beneath it, and she ran on, but not for a very long time, as suddenly a screaming west wind came upon us, stormily blowing, and the blast of the storm wind snapped both the forestays that were holding the mast, and the mast went over backwards, and all the running gear collapsed in the wash, and at the stern of the ship the mast pole crashed down on the steerman's head and pounded to pieces all the bones of his head, so that he, like a diver, dropped from the high deck, and the proud life left his bones there. Line 415. Zeus, with thunder and lightning together, crashed on our vessel, and, struck by the thunderbolt of Zeus, she spun in a circle, and all was full of brimstone. My men were thrown in the water, and bobbing like sea crows, they were washed away on the running waves all around the black ship, and the god took away their homecoming. But I went on my way through the vessel, to where the high seas had worked the keel free out of the hull, and the bare keel floated on the swell which had broken the mast off at the keel. Yet still there was a backstay made out of oxhide fastened to it. With this I lashed together both keel and mast, and then rowed the two of them, line 425, while the deadly storm winds carried me. Here we have an image of Odysseus with two giant logs lashed together, riding them like a horse on the sea. After this, the west wind ceased from its stormy blowing, and the south wind came swiftly on, bringing to my spirit grief that I must measure the whole way back to Charybdis. All that night I was carried along, and with the sun rising, line 430, I came to the sea rock of Scylla, and dreaded Charybdis. At this time Charybdis sucked down the sea's salt water, but I reached high in the air above me to where the tall fig tree grew, and caught hold of it and clung like a bat. There was no place where I could firmly brace my feet or climb up it, for the roots of it were far from me, and the branches hung out far, big and long branches that overshadowed Charybdis. Inexorably I hung on, waiting for her to vomit the keel and mast back up again. I longed for them, and they came late. What was it like? At the time when a man leaves the law court for dinner, after judging the many disputes brought him by litigious young men, that was the time it took the timbers to appear from Charybdis. What an interesting metaphor. It is like waiting for a lawyer. Then I let go my hold with hands and feet and dropped off, and came crashing down between and missing the two long timbers. But I mounted these, and with both hands I paddled my way out. Line 445. But the father of gods and men did not let Scylla see me again, or I could not have escaped from sheer destruction. From there I was carried along 9 days, and on the 10th night the gods brought me to the island Agagia, home of Calypso with the lovely hair, a dreaded goddess who talks with mortals. Line 450. She befriended me and took care of me. Why tell the rest of this story again, since yesterday in your house I told it to you and your majestic wife? It is hateful to me to tell a story over again when it's been well told. And that is the end of Book 12.